listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Keep Alert, the sermon by the Reverend Jean Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, December 3rd, 2017.
The second reading, the gospel reading, is from Mark, in the 13th chapter. And this chapter is often referred to by New Testament scholars as the little apocalypse of Mark. Let's see if we can hear a word of God for us. But in those days, after that suffering, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branches becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey, when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. In the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn. Or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. Please pray with me. Gracious God, be with us as we seek your will and your way in the words that have come down to us. Amen. Well now, that gospel reading seems like a strange place to begin our season of Advent, a passage from the little apocalypse of Mark. And yet it is always this way. Every first Sunday of Advent, we hear apocalyptic words. This chapter, chapter 13, is the longest speech by Jesus in Mark, and it's set between the triumphal entry into Jerusalem and the crucifixion, when Jesus and his friends are hanging out in Jerusalem, going to the temple, and preparing for the Passover. In the section we did not read today, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple, and then when four of the disciples ask for more details, he predicts wars and famines and earthquake, persecution and false prophets. This discipling business is not going to be easy. But Mark's first readers and hearers knew that. They were living, in about 70 of the Common Era, in a time of crisis, the time of the destruction of the temple. It was happening at that time. The loss of the temple represented a catastrophe of divine presence and a loss of continuity with the past. The temple was the center not only of religious life, but political and economic and social life also. This apocalyptic chapter in Mark is part of a long tradition of crisis literature, writings produced when a given moment calls into question the very presence of God and God's own righteousness. How can it be happening this way to the people who follow God? So here at the beginning of Advent, we pause for a moment before we rush headlong into the most tender part of the church year, to the infant in the manger and the friendly beasts all around him. we pause as our whole secular culture is straining toward festivity, and when our own hearts are straining toward the comforting vision of the baby Jesus asleep on the hay. We pause to listen to the adult Jesus talking about peril and danger and his second arriving. Given our current cultural and political situation, an apocalyptic text may, in fact, this year, fit our national mood. Things feel apocalyptic. Last Friday, while more men were being ousted from positions of influence for harassing and even attacking the women they work with, while a former national security advisor was being indicted, a rather cruel tax bill was working its crooked way to a late-night vote, while Korea was bragging about its nuclear capabilities, my best friend texted me to say, "Hey, did you hear about the earthquake in Philadelphia?" I burst out laughing. I mean, it sounded too much like a movie script. I was expecting zombies to start coming up out of the drains. But here is what an apocalypse is. Apokalupton, the Greek word, literally means to uncover. To uncover what is already there. The racism and violence and xenophobia and sexism, which we have been devastated to learn about in this country, was not created over the last 2 years. It's just been uncovered, revealed to us, and amplified. It's good to be reminded that we are not the first people in history to live in times of crisis, that there is a whole literature of crisis and uncovering. But when it does feel this way, as if at any moment the sun might just stop shining and the stars and moon fall out of the sky, the temptation is to be not just alert and vigilant, but hypervigilant and anxious and angry. I had to confess to my spiritual director the other day that I sometimes leave my phone now in the car or lock it in the closet so that I will not be tempted to pick it up and mindlessly scroll through Twitter. I realized as I spoke to her that I have been indulging in a little bit of magical thinking, that if I just pay close enough attention and stay vigilant, I can somehow be protected from whatever destruction is coming our way. I am almost certain that that is not what Jesus meant when he said, "Keep awake, beware, stay alert." We do not need to be reminded to be alert to bad news. I think I am not alone. I think many people across the country, here in this room, and in our homes, are already on edge between alert and exhausted, that place where despair is born and where bad decisions get made. I've had a little brush with hypervigilance in the past. Now, I didn't suffer anything like what people who have suffered real trauma experience, but the tiniest little window into what that feels like. I used to babysit a lot when I was a teenager, saving money for college. And one particular late spring evening, I was babysitting for a family with three young children, the youngest only 9 months old. I'd arrived late in the afternoon when their beautiful home was filled with golden afternoon light. And we had a wonderful time, the kids and I. We played in the yard and we played in the house, and I fed them the dinner their mother had left, gave them a bath, read them a story. The two older children went straight to sleep, but the younger one needed me to sing and stroke her back for a long time. I finally tiptoed downstairs so as not to wake her, and it was full dark. I sat first on the couch in the family room and got down to business with my calculus homework. Before long, I had slipped onto the floor so I could use the coffee table as a desk. But just as I did, I had the most uncanny sensation of being observed. I looked wildly around, but saw nothing. The house was quiet. I tiptoed back upstairs and checked on all three children. All was well. I tried to go back to my work through a mounting sense of panic, but I could not do it. So I did what most teenagers do. I called my mom. Now, this was back in the day when phones were anchored to the wall, so my face was in the facing the corner of the kitchen. And the uncanny feeling just kept intensifying. I whipped around just in time to see a face leering in the window above the kitchen sink. Thank God for long kitchen phone cords, I ran around a corner and hid in the corner of a room where I thought the person could not see me. My mom gave the phone to my brother on the other end. She called the police and then got in the car and came to me. It's been 40 years, and I am still getting anxious telling you this story. Fast forward 10 years. When David and I moved into our first apartment at the University of Virginia, we had hand-me-down everything, including shades and curtains for our living room and bedroom. And they didn't really fit all that well because they weren't made for those windows. We hadn't been married long before David noticed an odd little habit I had of fussing with those shabby secondhand shades and blinds to try to get every centimeter of the window covered. One evening, David drew the shade in the bedroom, and then he went to brush his teeth. I jumped up from my desk, and I began fussing with it. I couldn't not do it. He came in and found me at it, and he said laughingly, "What is the matter with you? No one is trying to peer in the window." "Ah, but you see, they might be, and it was up to me to stay vigilant." Now, you'll be relieved to know that I now live in a house that has no shades on the back windows, and I am perfectly fine. But that experience of not really identifying why I was hyper, for years, I didn't think about why I was hypervigilant about windows. I just was. That's the way I needed it to be. This unthinking, unreflective hypervigilance and watchfulness is, I believe, the opposite of what the gospel is calling for. Jesus is not calling us to be hypervigilant to the evil things all around us. He says, after the wars and rumors of wars and earthquake, then the sun will fail and the stars will fall down. And then from that fertile darkness, we will see God appearing. Unlike traditional apocalypses, which include a day of judgment, where some are sent to punishment, in Mark, Jesus says simply that the angels will go out and gather people in from the four winds. We'll see in this next lectionary year with Mark that the author portrays Jesus as a breaker of boundaries of all kinds, cultural, geographical, religious. And so those who are gathered in will be brought from the ends of the earth and the ends of heaven. In this time of crisis in our culture, we are being invited to stay awake. Despite the ugliness of the times, we are being invited to refrain from numbing ourselves by shopping, drinking, overeating, overworking. We are invited to stay aware of what is happening, but to be on the lookout for how God is arriving with power in the midst of it all, from the darkness, to be alert for signs of God's inbreaking presence, like the servants who have been left behind to keep the place running while the owner is away, and to be ready for the arrival of the one who will gather us in. Living as Mark's first hearers were in a time of crisis, living as we are now in a time of crisis, the inbreaking presence of God is not to be feared, but to be longed for. We are not preparing for the end of time, but the revelation of God in our time. Now, it takes practice to remain calmly alert. I keep in my mind an image of an athlete whose body is trained and full of power, but at ease with itself, or the image of a musician who has spent hours training their muscles, but in the moment of performance must be relaxed as well as wide awake. Marcus Borg describes this relationship with God as being like floating. He quotes the poet Denise Levertov, "As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky, and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air, and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all-surrounding grace." Here are a couple of practical suggestions for being alert to the inbreaking of God's reign. As I was reading and rereading both the text for this week and the news, I heard my heart say, "Be alert in this way. Go outside. Go outside and stand on the earth and breathe deeply. Rain or shine, lift your face to the sky. The trees will not deceive you, and the birds will not tell you lies. Rest in the knowledge that when humans are finally gone from the earth, it will recover from us. And in the meantime, all day, every day, it offers itself to our imaginations. So go outside and listen for those wild geese, harsh and exciting, and rest yourself in God's message of love in creation." And then, as a way to practice vibrant, hopeful alertness to the movement of God, I invite you to adopt or to renew, if you already have it, a practice of reviewing each day as it comes to a close. You'll need a quiet, comfortable place, uninterrupted. You may or may not want to journal. But sit in quiet and start by thanking God for the day that has ended. Then, asking the Spirit to guide you, cast your mind back over your day. Now, this is neither the Sports Center highlights of the day in 60 seconds, nor is it necessary to over-scrupulously examine every moment, every step, every thought. But think back over the flow of your day. You may find your mind keying in on different events, conversations, thoughts, and feelings, things that did not seem especially significant at the time. You do not need to force it. Allow yourself to be led. Notice when you felt most alive, most accepted, most connected to the spirit of life. You may find to your surprise, as you look back, that there are times when something outside yourself was protecting you, or challenging you, or greeting you with love. Times when you saw the face of God, but did not realize it in the moment. It may be that in the act of reviewing your day, you will be filled with a deep sense of peace. It may be that there were times you turned away from your own true self and let yourself down. Times when you hurt or let someone else down and clamped down on realizing it and did not let the knowledge into your mind. You can release that to God in trust and wonder. And then just float there in that presence, trusting. And ask for guidance for the next day. Now, this may seem a bit too small, a bit too individualistic, but it may be that this time-tested practice will lead us to awareness and fill us with confidence to live boldly in and for the world, seeing God's presence, participating in God's realm already here, keeping our eyes alert as we wait for God's coming in fullness and joy. Therefore, keep awake.
Listen, listen. Listen.